This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For nearly 40 years, the city of Belfast was synonymous with bombings, murders, and guerrilla warfare.
Police reported 56 hijackings, 17 bombings, 23 shooting incidents, and nearly 200 attacks on the security.
The conflict in Northern Ireland between the British government and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, ended in 1998. Officially, that is, but the troubles continued to bubble up in unexpected places. In 2013, Patrick Radden Keefe stumbled across an obituary of a woman named Dolores Price.
She was the first woman to serve as a real frontline soldier in the IRA. She was part of that civil rights movement in Northern Ireland in the late 1960s, and she got radicalized. And she ends up leading a bombing mission to England and getting arrested and going to jail and going on hunger strike.
She helped blow up the Old Bailey.
She helped blow up the Old Bailey. She led the mission, and this is when she's scarcely out of her teens. She goes toe-to-toe with Margaret Thatcher. Eventually, Thatcher lets her out of prison. And later in her life, after the peace process, she was very disaffected.
After the Troubles, Dolores Price took part in a secret oral history project. Members of the IRA were interviewed on tape about the acts of warfare and violence that they'd committed. The tapes were sent to Boston College here in the U.S., and each record was supposed to remain sealed until the interviewee had died.
And in 2013, when Dolores Price died, it had come out that she had been involved in what was one of the most notorious incidents in the Troubles, which was in 1972. There was a woman named Jean McConville, who was a mother of 10 and a widow, who was taken away by the IRA and disappeared. She was killed, but her body was buried in an unmarked grave. Her kids never knew what happened to her.
Why would she have been killed by the IRA?
The children didn't know at the time. What we learned later is that the IRA maintains to this day that she was an informant for the British Army.
She's a mother of 10. What could she possibly have known that it would have been of tremendous value to the IRA?
This is what her children, who are now adults, say, is that they really vehemently contest any suggestion that she had been an informant. They say, what would she know? She was trying to take care of us.
Is there an answer to that question?
There's not a definitive answer. In the book, I lay out the evidence on both sides, and there are people who today will swear up and down that she was and that she wasn't. So I don't know.
So what when you say they disappeared this woman, what exactly did they do to her? And when was it discovered?
Well, again, we didn't know. The children didn't know. You know, one night in December 1972, she's at home with her kids, and a group of people comes and knocks on the door in a housing project in West Belfast. They barge in. They have guns. They're masked. And they pull Jean McConville out. And her kids were quite young. The youngest were two twins who were 6 years old the time. They're clinging to her legs. They're screaming. These intruders say, we'll bring her back. We just want to talk to her. And they never saw her again. It was only in 2003 that her body was found.
2003, 30-odd years later.
31 years later, her body's found by a beachcomber in the Republic of Ireland walking along a beach one day.
So they're finding bones.
They found bones. And there had been some storms and so some erosion in that coastal area, and these bones were kind of churned up from the ground. And it was only more than a decade after that that people like Dolores Price started talking, and some of these secrets began to come out about the circumstances of this death.
Why would they talk?
because they experience great trauma. So part of what I was trying to do in this book is take one violent incident and approach it as you would a novel. And you've got a handful of compelling, interesting characters, real people, and you look at the way it affected them, the victims and the perpetrators alike, and how that played out over the decades. And for some of them, people like Dolores Price, there was a huge amount of trauma associated with the violent acts that she had committed in the name of a united Ireland. So she looks back as a mother herself, as somebody reaching middle age, and begins to reevaluate some of the things she's done.
And what access did you have to the papers at Boston College?
It was pretty limited. So they...
Because they're not all dead.
Well, there's that. But then the other thing is that there was a huge political fight. Part of the reason I thought there might be a story here, initially a magazine article, was that on the one hand, it's a story about a terrible murder that happened in 1972. On the other hand, it's a story about how that history, far from being remote or a closed case or a cold case that nobody's paying any attention to, was incredibly politically explosive.
How so?
Because more than one person had talked in this archive at Boston College about the circumstances of Jean McConville's death. And it emerged that people were pointing a finger at Gerry Adams.
So Gerry Adams, we should explain, is somebody who was always thought to be a leader of the Provisional IRA, involved in violent acts. He's always denied it. He was also a member of Parliament in Britain and a leader of the Irish political party, Sinn Féin. And he became a pivotal figure in the reconciliation in the 90s. So why would this be such a big deal all these years later?
Well, for a variety of reasons. One is that Adams, who I feel pretty comfortable saying was in fact a commander in the IRA for many years.
How do you know?
Because I've interviewed a whole bunch of people who are in the IRA with him, and because really it's Adams who maintains today that he was never in the IRA, and there's nobody else.
So you're saying that he ordered the killing of Jean McConville?
Yes. Yes. And more than one person who was involved has said this. He denies it, but he denies he was ever in the IRA. Look, it's funny. I did want to talk to Adams, but I was also mindful of that. Just because you get the interview doesn't mean he's going to tell you anything. I had this hilarious encounter when I was doing the reporting where I talked to a former IRA guy who's known Adams for a long time. And he was saying, look, even if he talks to you, he's not going to tell you anything. And I sort of said, hey, don't underestimate me. You know, I've got my ways. And the guy kind of chuckled and he said, you know, Jerry's had what they call counter-interrogation training. This means you could be torturing the man and he wouldn't tell you anything. And he looked at me and he says, but if you want to go in with your wee notebook, good luck to you.
Listeners, please note that was Patrick Keefe doing the imitation, not David Remnick. Now, Adams, you're saying, ordered this murder and ordered Dolores Price to do it. What was their relationship like and did it stay the same?
It didn't, and that's part of the dramatic arc of the book, is that there were a handful of people who were characters in the book who were very, very close when they were young members of the IRA in the early 1970s. And it wasn't just Dolores Price, it was her sister Marion Price, it was a guy named Brendan Hughes who was involved in many of these operations. And they did some awful things. They set bombs in public places, they killed people. And they did so in the name of a united Ireland. And then in the 1990s, Adams, whose political instincts had always been a little bit more evolved, perhaps, than some of his contemporaries in the IRA, starts to realize we're not going to fight the British into the sea. And so he starts taking part in this peace process. And what that means for Dolores Price and Brendan Hughes and some of these other people who took orders from Adams.
They feel betrayed.
Is that they feel betrayed. Mm. Is that they say, I did these things telling myself that the ends would justify the means. And what you've done is you've
that
changed the means.
That there would be a united Ireland.
There would be a united Ireland and there might be a great deal of bloodshed in order to get there, but we would get there. And you've changed the game. And then in addition to doing that, Adams would rather blithely say, oh, well, I personally was never in the IRA. I didn't order any of these things. I don't have any of that blood on my hands myself. And that drove some of these people mad. I mean, I think some of it was PTSD and trauma, but there was also a sense of a very acute sense of betrayal.
Clearly, you do not find Jerry Adams an attractive figure in many, many ways. On the other hand, this is a question of incredible historical significance in the region. And it was resolved, and it was resolved with Jerry Adams at the center of it. So in the end, how do you think history will treat Jerry Adams?
This is one of the great ironies of Adams as a figure. I find him emotionally very unsympathetic, downright sociopathic in his kind of clinical tendency to just cast aside anybody who's not useful to him anymore. But politically, Adams was the one who realized that you need to end this fight. And so I do think that there's an enduring irony in the idea that this is a man who was guilty of ordering perhaps the most notorious war crime of the conflict that he then helped to end.
So Say Nothing is, in my mind, two books at once. First, it's the best book about the Troubles I've ever read, and that's on one side. On the other, it's a murder mystery, and you solve it. Your book discusses Dolores Price. She was a possibility in your mind. An IRA member named Patrick McClure, who was a possibility for reasons that you get into. And there's a third person. And in a sense, this book is a whodunit. I don't want to make light of it, but there's a mystery that's solved here, and a third person is named. What is it like to accuse somebody of murder in a book, and have you heard from this person?
It was certainly the most intense decision I've ever made in my career as a reporter and writer, I'll tell you that. There was a lot of lawyering, as you'd imagine, and this person is still alive and had never been associated with this murder.
Had he or she been associated with any other murder?
Yes. So it was a former IRA member. But I'll put it to you this way, leaving aside the legal issue, morally, I would never have named the name and pointed the finger at someone and accused them of carrying out, you know, one of the most heinous war crimes of the Troubles, of a terrible conflict.
Have you gotten a response from the accused?
So I initially reached out to this person's lawyer in May and got nothing, and got in touch again, got nothing, and it said, I'm going to publish this book accusing your client. Nothing. The book came out in
Not even a response, a negative response, a cease and desist, anything?
Nothing. And the book came out in November in the UK and Ireland, in part because it had this news in it, which they wanted to get out because it was a fairly newsworthy thing over there. And it was excerpted in the Sunday Times. They got in touch with the lawyer a few days before publishing the excerpt, got a no comment. A few days after the book came out, this person released a statement saying it wasn't true, but that they wouldn't be saying anything more about it. And I've heard nothing since.
Now, one thing we've forgotten here is 10 kids lost their mother and became orphans instantly. What became of those 10 children, the McConville children?
Well, things didn't get any easier for them. It was heartbreaking. They initially tried to stay in the family apartment because they thought their mother might be coming back. But eventually the state stepped in and they said, look, if you're going to put us into a home, can you at least have us all be together? And the state split them up and put them in different orphanages. And those orphanages were every bit as bad as you might imagine that Irish orphanages would have been in this period of time. And so the kids were re-victimized in a whole series of awful ways.
When you made this name public, how did the kids, who are now obviously well grown, how did they react?
It was an intense experience. I wrote a letter to Jean McConville's children prior to the book coming out, telling them what I'd learned. And they'd always had a different idea of what might have happened. They were extremely surprised about the identity of the person who I pointed to. But what I heard from a lot of people who have watched this case closely and know some of the parties involved is, again, this idea that they were both shocked to learn the identity of this person. But when you thought about it, it made perfect sense.
Patrick, in many ways, the Troubles feel like a long time ago. You found that sources were still sometimes reluctant to talk to you, even now, for fear of the IRA. And as recently as last month, a car bomb was discovered in Northern Ireland, which is not good news. Do you feel as though the Troubles are somehow bubbling up again in some form or another?
Well, I think that...
And why is there an IRA?
Well, that's a big question. There's a line that Gerry Adams used famously. He was giving a speech and somebody in the audience yells, "Bring back the IRA." And Adams leaned into the microphone and said, "They haven't gone away, you know." And this is a big question in Northern Ireland, is this idea of, is the IRA still there? And there definitely is some form of it that continues to exist. And tensions are high. And I think they're only going to get higher if with Brexit we see some possibility of the return of a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and the North. So on one level, to the extent that there's a thesis in this book, it's that the past will not stay buried, and if you ignore this kind of history, it will come back and have its revenge. And I think we're seeing that a little bit in the Brexit context. Having said that, some of the more alarmist coverage of the situation recently has suggested that you could get a return to the bad old days of 1972, and I think that's pretty unlikely. I think that you could see on the margins great tension and maybe a little violence here and there, but I don't think there's the appetite for people to go back at this point.
Patrick Keefe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. His book about the Troubles and the murder of Jean McConville is called Say Nothing, and it comes out this week. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We are here with the alternative Oscars, better known as the Brodies, named for Richard Brody, who writes about film for the New Yorker. And I'm also here with Alexandra Schwartz, who writes about damn near everything for The New Yorker, books, theater, politics, and what have you. And Richard, I've got to ask you, what's going to win the lowly real Oscars, do you think, just to start?
I think that Roma's going to win.
And you're anti-Roma.
I'm not a big fan of Roma. I think that Roma has its own problems of aesthetics and of politics.
The political problem that you see with it is that, in a sense, that the main character, the cleaning woman, the nanny, doesn't have a voice.
Doesn't have a voice, exactly.
We don't know her past.
We don't even know her real relationship with the children in the house.
But at least, Richard, you could say that it's an auteurist movie and you love auteurs.
Well, not necessarily. You know, there's that great line from André Bazin, auteur, yes, but of what?
Touché.
There we go. We're off to the races. Richard, let's just go through your nominees for Best Picture. You have a couple of them are pretty well known, and some of them aren't. So just go through them.
One of the ones that's well known is Sorry to Bother You, Boots Riley's first feature, about a young man, a young black man in Oakland, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who is working as a telemarketer and is encouraged by a colleague, played by Danny Glover, to put on his white voice in order to succeed.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. You have a white voice in there, you can use it. It's like when you're pulled over by the police.
Oh, no, I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the fuck up off the car and don't nobody get hurt.
All right, man, I'm just trying to give you some game. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
And it's a movie about class as much as it is about race, isn't it?
It's about class. It's about politics. It's about labor politics. It's essentially an apocalyptic revolutionary film.
Okay. Second nominee?
Second nominee, Black Klansman, Spike Lee's historical drama and at the same time sort of historical fantasy about the combating of the KKK in a Colorado police precinct by a white and a black officer.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
Well, I've established contact and created some familiarity with the Klansman over the phone. I'll continue in that role, but I'll need another officer. Surprise, surprise, a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
That's my point exactly.
Chief, black Ron Stallworth over the phone, white Ron Stallworth face to face, so there becomes a combined Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
I believe we can. With the right white man, we can do anything.
It's an outrage that Spike Lee has never been nominated for a directing Oscar before.
Now, how do you think Spike Lee will make out, and what was your view of Black Klansman?
It's weirdly hopeful retroactively. And at the same time, it's a history lesson. There's a tremendous amount of cultural context in Black Klansman. It's, in effect, a movie that takes the cultural background and pulls it into the foreground.
And brings it up to the present. I mean, one of the things that I think about most often with Black Klansman was the kind of use that Spike Lee made of footage that all of us have watched on TV, you know, of Charlottesville and I think in other events, and how emotional and freshly terrible it felt to watch that kind of footage that we've all seen but recontextualized.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the film that I think it really is the Brody film of the year is, and I can't do a drum roll. There we go.
Madeline's Madeline, Josephine Decker's film. Madeline's Madeline is a very classic and somewhat classical coming-of-age story. The story of a high school student in New York who is both a theater prodigy and who is suffering from mental illness, and also who, like all teenagers, is in a very stressful relationship with her mother, played by Miranda July. But what's so exciting about this film is that Helena Howard, who was a teenager at the time she made the film, gives what I consider one of the greatest teen performances in the history of cinema. There's one scene, an improv exercise in her theater troupe, where she's impersonating her own mom, and you see some of the raw fury she feels toward her mother coming out in that scene.
When you were just a little baby, I stroked your head so soft. I said to myself, I said, this baby, she's so perfect. She's gonna be so strong. And look at you now. You are sick. You're so sick.
So Madeline's Madeline is sweeping Best Picture and Best Director and Best Actress in the Brodies. Now we come to Best Actor, Richard. And this, I think, is going to surprise a few people.
I thought that Robert Redford's performance in The Old Man and the Gun, a movie with a New Yorker connection because it's based on a story by David Gran that originally ran in The New Yorker, is the most extraordinary performance I saw from a man this year.
Right. And it's about a guy who, in the beginning of the film, you think he's just a charming rogue and he robs banks, but he doesn't hurt anybody and he doesn't really mean it. What you realize after a while is he's a sociopath. Mm-hmm. He can't live without knocking over banks.
Mm-hmm.
This place is not my style. But say it was a bank. And instead of that counter up there, that was really a teller's window. And that lady standing there was the teller behind the window. And you just walk in real calm, and you find yourself a spot, and you sit down, just like we're sitting here. And you wait, and you watch. And that may take a couple of hours, might take a couple of days even, but you wait. It's got to feel right. The timing has to feel right. And when it does feel right, you make your move. So you walk right up, look her in the eye, and you say, ma'am, this is a robbery. And you show her the gun like this.
Redford does something here that I've never seen him do before. It's a performance of tremendous intimacy. Every tremor of his eyebrows, every half smile on his lips, every wink, every gleam is picked up by the camera and seems to convey a lifetime of experience and slyness.
And now we're going to talk about the real Oscars for a moment. So we come to two films that seem to dominate the nominations. You've got Roma and The Favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I already expressed my admiration for Roma. I really love The Favorite, and I thought it was incredibly funny, and I had no reason to know this film was going to be what it was, having seen that director's predecessors, which are The Lobster.
Right.
And that movie with
a deer,
killing a sacred deer. I thought The Favorite was incredibly funny and interesting. Did you see it?
Yeah, I did see it. And, you know, I was not a fan of The Lobster, which I felt to be too... Yes, the face that you're making, David, conveys my feelings about it as well. I felt that it was too solipsistically invested in its own conceits. But The Favorite was something really different and fresh. And it is about Queen Anne, who in the movie is played by Olivia Colman, who is wrapped up in sort of governing England as it is at war, but more in her own personal affairs. She has 17 rabbits in cages kept in her bedroom. And she, her lover, is played by Rachel Weisz in a fantastic performance, who guides her and uses her erotic influence to get political favors accomplished. And her standing at court is compromised when Emma Stone, as a sort of tumbleweed figure, arrives, falls out of a carriage into the mud and arrives and screws everything up.
You have become close to Abigail.
She's been a dear, yes.
It is such a shame, but I've had to dismiss her for theft. She's a liar and a thief. Your tongue seems uncharacteristically still.
I heard you. She's my servant. She's not dismissed. I've made her my maid of the bedchamber.
Did you not hear what I said?
Yes, you regard her as a liar and a thief?
Yes.
I do not, obviously.
Alex and Richard, if you look at the sort of sum total of the nominees this year, are the Oscars doing better? Are they doing worse? Or is it just kind of the same old, same old?
Well, two things that come to my mind looking at the nominees are, one, I am perpetually disappointed by how few women directors are nominated. I mean, first of all, it's a major imbalance in the industry in general. But this year, there were definitely contenders, and there was no reason to have this total shutout once again. So it's disappointing to me, and it brings the Academy's credibility down in my eyes, not simply for some kind of gender ratio ideal, but really for, you know...
Gender ratio at all.
Yeah, at all. And just appreciating quality when it's there. It's hard for me to believe that if a movie like Can You Ever Forgive Me had been made by a man, that it would not be nominated.
I think you were going to make another point, though, Alex.
Yeah, the one thing I'd say is the enemy is inside the house. You have Netflix. It has arrived. Roma is nominated up the wazoo for all these awards. The Oscars have had to deal with increasing competition from TV, from people, you know, sitting at home and flicking it on. It's interesting to me that Netflix is now going to be sitting inside that ceremony and has every reason to have a pretty smug look on, you know, its face.
Is there anything wrong with that?
I don't think there is, actually. I mean, independent producers have been rivaling Hollywood studios for years. In fact, this is one of the reasons why the ceremonies have been transformed in recent years.
Right.
For quite a while, studio films have more or less been shut out of the Oscars, at least the Best Picture Awards, because independent producers were coming in and producing the higher quality films that were then getting nominated. See, I think the Oscars' mistake is actually to broadcast itself at all. It ought to be a movie. You know, Martin Scorsese ought to direct the Oscars the way he directed The Last Waltz, and then it ought to be shown in theaters a certain amount of time later.
That's a pretty great idea.
That's a great idea, but I think Martin Scorsese's view of the Oscars after Raging Bull lost to Ordinary People, something I still haven't gotten over quite, too jaundiced for him to carry that off year after year. So I'm guessing, by the way, A Star is Born was not your favorite for the year.
You know who was originally supposed to direct A Star is Born? That was going to be directed by Eastwood. Beyonce was going to have the Lady Gaga.
Exactly.
Roles.
I think you once told me, Richard, Clint Eastwood could put two sticks and rub them together and it would be a great movie.
Richard, Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you.
You can read Richard Brody on film at NewYorker.com all the time. And Alexandra Schwartz is a staff writer.
Step to the right, please.
Costume designer Ruthie Carter has had a pretty remarkable career in movies, going all the way back to Spike Lee's third film in 1988. She's been nominated 3 times for the Academy Award, but it's her work on last year's film, Black Panther, that really blew up. You saw people all over the country in homemade Black Panther costumes on Halloween. Now Ruth Carter is getting her due as one of the leading designers in Hollywood, and her work was shown at this year's Fashion Week in New York.
So we're at Spring Studios for the Ruth Carter exhibit called Next of Kin. Next of Kin features designs from and inspired by I'm Gonna Get You Sucka, School Days, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, What's Love Got to Do with It, Selma, Chi-Raq, and Black Panther. And that, of course, is only a fraction of the projects that Ruth Carter has worked on.
In fact, she's so busy that when staff writer Doreen St. Felix wanted to interview Carter, she had to catch her at the star-studded opening night party, where the costume from 1988's I'm Gonna Get You Sucka was on display. They were platform shoes with live goldfish swimming around in the soles.
Hey!
How are you?
The goldfish shoes are a necessary addition, of course. Hopefully there won't be any snafus with the fish.
No, they got them.
I remember on the set we had extra fish, so if something, heaven forbid.
So let's go back to the 80s. You're a student at Hampton University, and you decide that you want to switch to theater arts. What inspired that? I know that you weren't necessarily thinking that you wanted to work in costume and design when you first enrolled there.
Well, I was always hanging out with the theater students anyway. I was auditioning for plays. I came from experiences with theater in high school, after school, summer school.
What were some of the plays that you were in when you were in high school?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yes. I was Benita in A Raisin in the Sun.
Yes.
I was Alberta in Sty of the Blind Pig. My directing final was Day of Absence.
Wow.
I had the best instructors. Like, they were my mentors, my first mentors, because they were the ones that introduced me to Alice Walker and Wole Soyinka,
right,
and all of the plays that the Negro Ensemble Company was doing at the time when I was in college. I wanted to be around them, and I wanted to be doing black theater because I was reading all the plays.
Right.
I still have the books I had back then. And when I graduated, I wanted more. And I knew I needed more training as a costume designer, so I did internships.
At the Santa Fe Theater.
The Santa Fe Opera in New Mexico. I was there for a season, and then I drove to L.A. still thinking, I'm going to get to NEC, you know.
But it didn't quite happen that way.
No, I got to Spike Lee.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you then come from, you know, meeting him and then working on School Days?
Well, it actually was him coming to a performance, dance performance, where I had did the costumes for the dancers. And my senior recital was dance costumes at Hampton. I did our touring company. And he came, and he told me to get more experience in film. He inspired that. And from there, I, you know, just thought about film, but really didn't think that it was dynamic enough, because I had just done opera, and then I felt like film was so realistic, it didn't translate immediately to me. I had to learn how to be a film costume designer, because theater, you have aesthetic distance. And you, the eye just eliminates detail as it travels to its subject. And with film, it's blown up 600 times its size. So the details are much more prominent than they are when if they were on stage. So I had to actually learn how to dial it back. But for school days, because it was a little bit more theatrical, it was the perfect film to start with. We had the fraternity, pledgees, we had the gamma rays, and we did a musical production, two of them, three of them in that film. There was a step show, and it was a subject that I had lived. Having gone to an HBCU, Hampton University, I knew all of that.
I think a lot about how costumes are so important in terms of establishing continuity in a film.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I know film sets can end up being a little crazy.
Yeah.
Were there any times where a piece got lost and a character needed it and you had to find a way create it again?
Okay, so in school days, Kym Hershey wears a sweater that I designed with African masks on it. And a dear, dear friend who was a part of my internship, she was a draper, and she knit every day. I sent her the idea, and she knit that sweater for me. So my first film, I thought about Georgia Carney Darling, who could knit, and she told me how to lay out the pattern so that she could count the stitches and make that sweater with African masks on it.
Incredible.
And at the end of the show, which I thought it was the end of school days, it was the last day of shooting, I was hell-bent on keeping that sweater. So towards the end of school days, I packed the sweater with my personal belongings and sent it to the airport, and we needed that sweater for another scene, and I didn't realize it. And it was one of a kind. So we, in the middle of the night, traveled to the airstrip, and we managed to get the sweater.
Wow. So you're on an airstrip in the middle of the night getting this sweater.
Oh, my God. Digging out of my boxes, that sweater. I was hell-bent on keeping it. And then Spike gave it to Kym Hershey.
He didn't even give you
no!
the sweater?
No, he did not.
Down.
Ruth E. Carter, who's been nominated for the Oscar in costume design for her work on the film Black Panther. She spoke with Doreen St. Felix, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, I'm going to try to describe a long, complicated journey. So get out your mental map of the United States. Start at the headwaters of the Mississippi River in northern Minnesota, get in a canoe, go all the way down the Mississippi past New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico. Now turn around and head north, paddling up the Mobile River. Take a couple of turns into Tennessee, almost to the Virginia border. Now hitch a ride over the Appalachian Mountains and then get back in the water and go down the James River, eventually reaching the Atlantic near Portsmouth, Virginia. It sounds impossible, but a man named Dick Conant spent years taking voyages just like that.
He wasn't some wild kid. Conant started canoeing in his 40s. He was overweight, and he had some medical problems to boot. And he told all this to Ben McGrath, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, after they met by chance just outside Ben's house in the suburbs of New York. And Ben has this story of a difficult but truly remarkable life.
So here we're in the town of Piermont, New York, which is about 15 miles north of the George Washington Bridge on the west side of the Hudson River. And I like to go kayaking, usually in the mornings. And the day I met Dick, which was Labor Day of 2014, I was going to take my two-year-old kayaking. And my neighbor peeked his head over that wall and he said, there's somebody in here who I think you might want to meet. So I started walking over to my neighbor Scott's house, and you know, before heading inside, I noticed at this point that there's this dirty red canoe tied up to the base of his seawall. It's covered in tarps and some trash bags maybe, and it's got army duffels. I mean, it really looked like it had been packed for the apocalypse. And inside, sitting at the head of a long rectangular table, was Dick Conant. He said he was 63, and he had a big beard, and he was bright red. And he probably weighed 300 pounds. He had these dusty denim bib overalls. I mean, I remember having the impression that it was as though Santa Claus had canoed into town. And he was kind of holding forth, and I gathered that he was about 2 months into a journey that he expected to last at least another six more months. And he had begun up by the Canadian border and was basically going to be taking a chain of rivers and canals down the Atlantic seaboard and ending up in Florida. And he was on this journey for, from what I could tell, no particular reason. It quickly became clear that this was not his first insane voyage. In fact, within a couple of minutes of my arriving, he was telling a story about how he once almost got run over by a barge on the Mississippi at night. As it happened, he'd basically been crisscrossing the country alone in a canoe for the better part of two decades. But I missed the opportunity to really draw him out on the particulars of those trips because I did, after all, have my two-year-old with me, and he was threatening to destroy my neighbor's house. So it wasn't really until the next morning when I woke up and thought, okay, I gotta find this guy again. So I got some binoculars and drove down south, and after a while, sort of hiking along the shore, I was able to see off in the distance this flashing yellow plastic paddle. When he got within earshot of me, I yelled his name and started waving him ashore. And he backed the boat in, and he just decided to set up camp right there.
I'm due for a good break. I might make camp right here. I'm exhausted.
Right.
Is there a place you can sit? Do you have something to drink, like a soda pop?
I don't, unfortunately. Sorry.
Would you like one?
No, you don't want to waste your supplies.
Yeah, it's no waste. Believe me.
And I started talking, and I began to learn the very long and mysterious life of Dick Conant.
I was born in Germany. We lived in Germany for 3 years. My dad was with Army Armor, so we moved down to Kentucky, Fort Knox, for 4 years.
But when I was he had grown up, actually, a bit of an Army brat. He'd been all over the place, but most of his schooling as a boy was done in Pearl River, New York. Pearl River is a pretty ordinary suburb now. But in the 50s and 60s, when he was there, they did really think of it as kind of Mark Twain country. It was winding country roads, and the upper reaches of the Hackensack River were there. And they had a little dinghy, and they would kind of go up and down. Dick, in fact, invented a club that it was called Catfish Yacht Club. So there's a way in which, throughout all of his life, he saw himself as a kind of an epic adventurer. He was at the top of his high school class. He had a full scholarship to college. He was a hugely talented man who had, because of various troubles he had, not amounted to much in a conventional sense.
Navy. I had a really checkered career, what you call.
Right.
I worked on the railroad in Wyoming for.
He had worked on the railroad in Wyoming. He had worked on the oil rigs. He was a coal miner. He was a janitor. He worked in hospitals. He was a weather observer. He was in the Navy. He worked selling, most recently before I met him, he'd been selling bus tickets at a Greyhound station. So I think, you know, the fact that he hadn't achieved, and one of the phrases that he didn't have a white picket fence, he didn't have a family.
I'm at 63 years old.
Right.
You know, these adventures are incredible. They really are. However, I would much rather be at home with a woman.
Right.
And a family like you had.
Right. And he was homeless.
Well, one of the reasons I go on these trips is because, I don't have an apartment.
Okay. When he wasn't paddling, he camped outside in what he called a swamp in Bozeman, Montana.
People call it homeless. I don't. I've been living like this since 2007.
From talking to him, it was clear that he was extremely well-read, both in a historical sense with literary references and historical references, but also could more than hold his own when talking about current events.
You know, when this trip is over, I'll sit down and write a prose account.
He told me that he'd written several books, and in fact, I think had a couple of them with him in the boat on flash drives.
Well, I've written 3 books.
Oh, okay.
I'm just not published.
Okay.
By the time I get finished writing a book, I'm ready to go on another trip.
The books read like journals. Each of them is a chronological account of a particular transcontinental canoe trip.
November 13th, 1999. I visited with a dog. This damn thing followed me for 2 miles along the riverbank after I got underway. November 14th, 1999. I saw an interesting sight today. A bald eagle was pestering and chasing a great heron in midair. He ran him... August 12th, 2009. I'm up at dawn. I paddle all day. I see eagles and other wild... January 18th, 2010. I'm on a tawny sand beach listening to squawking birds. January 4th, 2000. My abode, my bedroom... is a gravel riverbank, and my living room is the greatest river system of the most beautiful country on earth. August 20th, 1999, some guy and his wife woke me up from a nap at Lewis and Clark State Park. He asked me if that was my rig in the river. I said the red canoe was mine. He asked me where I was going. I said the Gulf of Mexico. He asked me, eventually, why? I told him I got tired of TV and automobiles, and so I just took off and jumped in the river. He and his wife stared at me blankly. Like Pat Schroeder used to say, some of you people just don't get it.
He was physically a very striking man, you know, very large, always wore overalls. He apparently rode a bike that was often too small for him. He had a kind of a booming, if gentle, voice. And in a town, in a place, you get a man who looks like that on land, and that person sticks out in a way that makes people uncomfortable. And he was very aware of that. Bozeman, Montana is a relatively small town where if you're a 300-pound man who wears overalls and rides a bicycle back and forth, people do know you and notice you again and again and probably do roll their eyes or whisper things. There's that guy on the bike again. When he's on the river and he emerges into a new town, he's not that guy, he's this guy. And the difference between that guy and this guy was everything to him.
September 17th, 2007. At the risk of sounding like a whining crybaby complainer, I've got to get some baggage off my shoulders. The people in Bozeman did not appreciate my talent or skills or, God forbid, my robust personality. I am not a wealthy man, unless I consider the innate skills granted to me by nature. As this present odyssey can convey, I am an unabashed and gifted adventurer.
Because he had been a successful kid and student and athlete and all these things, he had a strong sense of his own talents and potential. And yet by middle age, he clearly hadn't reached any of it in a conventional sense, at least. And so the canoeing, which really he took up, I think his first long trip, he was 43 years old. So in a way, you could think of it as a midlife crisis. But it became a way for him to shift that sense of squandered potential into a real sense of accomplishment. It became a career in which he could excel.
September 17th, 2007. This is a good opportunity to reiterate a concept which is very real and quite stabilizing in the psychological aspect. Though I am no king of the Irish, or any warrior king, when I am out on the water in my canoe, I do call the shots. My time is my own. It belongs to me. Though in most places I visit, I am treated with friendship and generosity and often kindness in the extreme, I am beholden to no one.
My main goal at the time had been simply to write a short talk of the town story for the magazine about an unusual man who had passed through town. And I think the story came out in late September. October 20th, he sent me an email saying that he was hale and hearty in Delaware City, Delaware. And at that point, I believe he said he was preparing for his next leg, which was across Chesapeake Bay, and didn't hear anything again until November 29th. It was a Saturday, and I was getting lunch ready for my kids. And I got a phone call from a number I did not recognize, and it was a wildlife officer in North Carolina saying he was investigating a missing boater. And it took me no more than 2 seconds to realize who he was talking about. As it turned out, some duck hunters had found a canoe, but not a canoeist. And in going through the boat, they had found my phone number in it. The point where they found the boat, it was turned upside down up against some cypress knees. And it was on the Albemarle Sound in North Carolina. And if you look south across the sound at that point, it's like 12 miles across. I mean, you can't see the other side. You might as well be on, you know, Lake Michigan. So they thought they had a huge search area, and they didn't know when he'd gone missing because his itinerary was known only to himself. Dick had 7 living siblings. Not one of them knew where he was or what he was up to. If they knew, it was only because I'd written an article in the Talk of the Town section.
I wanted to visit my mother and siblings. Some of them I had not seen in over 25 years. If you don't visit once in a while, you end up forgetting altogether.
After he had gone missing, I went back to my notes and I saw the part in my conversation with him when he mentioned his older brother Joe in Peachtree City, Georgia. I looked up Joe's phone number at that point when I got the call from the officer, and I gave the officer Joe's phone number, and that's how the family found out. Unfortunately, you know, I think there was an initial wish on the part of friends he'd met and his family members to think, well, maybe he, you know, look, he lived a free and kind of untethered life to begin with. Maybe he just decided to ditch the boat and go somewhere else. The thing that makes that seem unlikely is that, you know, he already lived pretty close to off the grid. As much as he wanted to, he was able to accomplish it. You know, he lived outside in Bozeman, Montana. He paddled where he wanted to, when he wanted to. They found a mountain of stuff in his boat, his wallet, his naval discharge papers, his journals, his maps, his money, his food, his tent. His body is still not accounted for. They have been tracking his bank account since he went missing, and the only activity in his bank account is the monthly automatic deposit of his Social Security. It was a weird and almost unsettling feeling to think that sort of just by happenstance I'd become the link between Dick and his largely estranged family, and it felt very personal. A few months after the news had kind of had settled in, I ended up meeting with a couple of his brothers who live closer to me, and they began sharing with me some of his manuscripts and talking to me about their childhood. One of the things that became clearer was that he was sensitive to an extreme and sometimes paranoid and delusional degree. In fact, when he was in the Navy in his 30s, he was briefly placed on mental leave. But I think the most elegant way of putting it is something Dick himself said to his mother, apparently, after he completed one of these trips. And that's that he told her that he'd been contending with mental barnacles.
March 31st, 2010. I am paranoid, so I spent some time camouflaging my camp. It is small and tight, but I am getting paranoid. It looked like another setup. If I got friendly with one woman, the other would have reported. September 16th, 2009. One can never be certain of what another will do when he or she is truly afraid. March 5th, 2010. Now I am increasingly thinking that my visit had more sinister aspects to it than I... November 15th, 2007. I began to think in terms of the infinite variety of turns a human mind can twist to fabricate and mold. Given irrefutable facts, a determined mind can construct a total delusion out of a whole cloth and thereby satisfy a gnawing yet wishful thought process.
This is one of the reasons why he would often move, is I think he, ultimately, if he spent too many days in one place, he began to worry that he'd overstayed his welcome, and he felt that he had to go, which is a shame, because in many cases, when I call the people who were there, they only remember him fondly. They don't remember the offending incident that made him think that he had to go.
December 20th, 2007. I began to feel like a heel when I finally empathized with him, with Wayne. The feeling that I had offended him and his friends began to gnaw at my mind. It would continue to do so for some time to come. I just frankly didn't know any better. My ignorance of social niceties this late in life is fairly deplorable, but I guess it comes with the territory. I find it a bit disconcerting that of the many friends I have met on this adventure, most I will never see again.
You know, when I look back at the talk story I wrote, I wonder sometimes, in light of what happened, about a comment that an old family friend of Dick's made. I think it was something like, you know, what Dickie needed was not an article in The New Yorker, but an intervention. I feel pretty strongly that isn't true. I really think, in light of what I've come to understand about his past and some of the difficulties he faced in his head, is that I really think that the rivers were a survival mechanism for him. And he himself would often write that he was surprised that he was still alive, and not because he'd been doing this crazy river paddling, but because of other things that had happened in his life. For Dick, it wasn't a lark. It was simply his way of being.
January 18th, 2008. Frankly, if somebody prefers the domestic life, that is the life he leads or pursues. If he prefers to wander, then he takes off. This stuff about finding oneself is a bunch of baloney. I repeat that I am not out here finding myself. I was never lost. What I am doing is paddling around, finding geography I have not seen, observing various industry and transport, experiencing wildlife, meeting new people, most of whom are worth meeting, and having a jolly good time before I die.
It was the only way that Dick could be happy in the world was moving along through a river. He himself seemed to think that when he first began doing this as a serious line of work, so to speak, which was more than 15 years ago, that was the beginning of saving his life rather than ending it.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I will find
you. I love telling about my trip. I don't care if I get published or not, you get published or not, but I do enjoy relating.
Yeah.
That's half the fun.
Are you be careful.
All right.
Drive safely.
Very good.
Best for your wife and child.
Will do.
One or the other.
All right. Thank you. Will do.
Ben McGrath talking with Dick Conant. Excerpts from Conant's journals were read for us by Peter Gallagher. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again soon. Same time, next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.